National Council of Jewish Women, Pittsburgh Section. Today is July 19th, 1985. This is Arlene Shapiro and Harold Kimball interviewing Hi Kimmel. This is tape two. Hi, in the last interview, many interesting things about your life and your work and about Zionism were discussed. Today I would like to add to our information. First of all, I remember you said that when you were five, you and your parents came to Canada. When was that? What year was that? Do you recall?
I don't recall. I think it was in 1927, I think that's when we came to Canada, I believe. Because my grandfather and his family settled in Canada before Norton United in Canada. Mm-hmm. And they brought us over when I was 5 years old, and we came over from Europe. My grandfather, I indicated before, we come from a family that had a lot of religious origins. Mm-hmm. For example, my grandfather was a shamus in a shul in Winnipeg, and all my four uncles lived there. They were in business, but I can vividly recall that my grandfather's life was centered around religious life, and he was a shamus in the shul. And interestingly enough, my father was a chazan, and he came to America before we did. My father came before we did, I think a couple of years before, and an uncle of mine, who later became a physician, came to Europe to take our family, to bring my mother and one sister to bring us to Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. And from Winnipeg, of course, my father was a chazan, therefore his career was not a permanent career. He lasted for a couple of years in Winnipeg, and then he went to Boston, and he was there for a couple of years, and then he went to Detroit, he was there for a couple of years as a chazan. Mm-hmm. And finally came to Pittsburgh, and that's where we last spent most of our life. The whole concept of Jewish living in those days was quite different than it is today. The whole panorama of Jewish identity and Jewish values then were pretty well settled in the area of the life of an immigrant. And it made, you know, quite a difference in the way we lived and what we looked forward to. We were in poverty. We were poor people. We didn't have very much of anything. But we stayed in Boston for a couple of years, East Boston. I went to school there, and then we went to my younger brother was born in East Boston. By the way, Yom Kippur Day. He was born on Yom Kippur Day. And from there we came to Pittsburgh, where my father got a position. And I remember vividly, and I don't know how significant that is, you recall in those days, well, not even in current years, it was the Blank Brothers, the Undertakers, right. And they were very prominent, and they were leaders in the synagogue. My father had a shul up on the Hill District on Miller Street, I think called Shard's Hillish Shul Synagogue. And I recall vividly coming to Pittsburgh, and who picked us up to take us to our home was the car from the Blank Brothers. Mm-hmm. You know, this is little things like that, I think, range in your mind. But I think what is really significant is that in the radical changes of Jewish life, mm-hmm, in the past 40 years, the changes in the economic life of the Jews, the changes in the value systems of the Jews.
Could you tell us your impressions, some important
things? Prestigious position that they held was one within the Jewish community. I think that is of some importance. Consequently, in our youth, and our schooling, and our youth, we were part of this environment. Consequently, the what was important to Jews in the Hill District then was not to acquire wealth, because they couldn't acquire wealth, but rather to stress Jewish education, and consequently I was given a very intensive Jewish education. I attended the Hebrew Institute, I had private instructors, and I had instructors in Talmud. When I was 13 years old, I didn't have to go to school to learn the Haftarah. I had already spent a couple of years studying Talmud, and it was a natural thing with us. You know, we were very religious in our home, and daily prayers is part of living. Every day when you got up in the morning, even before you were 13, you davened every morning. When you were 30, you put on film. When you came back from school, you went to Hebrew school. When you got through with Hebrew school, you had a private instructor. And when you got home on a weekend, your father made sure that he reviewed with you what you had studied. So you can see the impact of Judaism was an impact which started in those days very early. And we were not alone in this. You know, we, of course, I continued to attend the Hebrew Institute for a number of years and was graduated from there.
When did you graduate from the Hebrew Institute,
and then I attended their high school, was graduated from high school, and then I attended their teacher's training school. And while I was going to the University of Pittsburgh, I also attended the Hebrew Institute special class in Talmud, and I received a degree in Hebrew instruction. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing, the whole panorama centered around Jewish life. It was not, that was the ideal aspiration of a Jew. It was not, do we get new cars, do we move to Squirrel Hill, or do we get new homes, or do we have maids? Such things are unknown, though, that your mother was a maid, you know, and that sort of thing. And I think the whole attitude of relationships of Jews with Jews were quite different than they are now. I'll give you some specific examples. My father was a cantor, and also a moyel, did circumcisions and all, for most of his adult life. And the salary at the top of, if I remember correctly, about $3,000 a year. That was his salary. We had four kids at home.
Was the average income at that time? Any idea? I mean, was that considered poor? Or
well,
was that considered
I think it was average. Mm-hmm. You know, people in those days, most people that we knew, they lived in the Hill District, and they had very little to look forward to accepting the normal everyday existence. But there was a value system which very much coordinated with the economy in which we were all involved.
What do you mean it coordinated with the economy?
Well, I mean we didn't expect too much. We mm-hmm. because we didn't have the values of lots of funds, means of money, we concentrated on education. And that compensated for very much the lack of other things. Mm-hmm. I think that was the relevance of those years. I remember the IKC building on Center Avenue, which was a part of our, we weren't even involved in that. Because we were too busy trying to do the everyday living. And I went to Fifth Avenue High School.
When did you graduate from high school?
I think I graduated in 1938 or 39, if I remember correctly. But even there, there was no time for us, for our status and our values to be involved in social life. We had little social life. We didn't learn to go to dances, you know. We just didn't do it.
Among the Jewish community, at the Jewish Community Center and things
they
like
were
that?
Very, the Jewish community, they had students in my class who had a big social life and went to that. Well, I didn't, because primarily in our home, we had different interests.
It was a more Orthodox home, do you think that
very
was
very Orthodox. What I wanted to tell you about the value system is this, that in contrast to the value system of people in general, and Jews in particular now, is to become socially recognized. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. And that developed more and more as the years went by, when the Jews increased their economy and moved to Squirrel Hill. Then the value system, I think, began to pretty much change. And of course, it changed completely with the years prior to the Jewish state and the years after. It completely changed. I recall vividly, and I think it's good sometimes to think these things through, matters relating to a value system. I know now that if I would come home today and tell my wife that tonight I'm bringing two guests for dinner, she'd hit me over the head. She'd say, "Are you crazy? My house isn't clean. I'm not prepared. I didn't buy the right food. I just don't feel like I can do it. I can't properly make the social impression that I should be making. Can't do it." In contrast, in those days, it was a common practice for my father, who was a chazan, would come home from shul on a whatever day and say, "Look, I brought this rabbi, the itinerant rabbi, and he needs something to eat, and he has no place to stay, and we had a family of four kids and five rooms, and we need to give him a chance to stay overnight." That was part of our value system. Mm-hmm. And there was no question asked. There was always room for one more, and always food for one more, and always mm-hmm. place for one more. And we just lived that way. Mm-hmm. It was the accepted way of life. I think it indicates the radical changes in our value system. You know, in relating to the value system, in my many years of schooling, I can't remember all the courses I took at the university, and I can't remember all the books that I read, and I can't remember any of the lectures. You absorb it as a whole. But I do remember one concept, and it relates itself to Jewish life. The concept is that our whole life is determined by our value system. We do what is important to us. And it carried over in my work with the ZOA for more than 30 years in so many ways. One thing that Jewish life today is organizational life. And one worry that directors have is to get people to come to meetings and to get people to come to events. And, you know, this is a real burning question. You know, you go crazy. Think about how many are going to come? The subject of my book is going to be the turnout. And it will relate itself. Who are the people that create the turnout? And why do we have the turnout? And what's its value? And that's the subject of the book that I'm working with.
I didn't know you were planning to write a book.
But you see, the value system mm-hmm. is something which really governs our life today. And in my work, specifically, I came to the conclusion in fundraising and in education and in community attitudes, people do what they want to do. And they go where they want to go. And they give where they want to give. And money is not the object, and weather is not the object, and dates are not the object, because I know that if you put something on which triggers off attention, mm-hmm. people are going to come. Mm-hmm. I've seen them come in zero weather with a blinding snowstorm to fill up a room. And I've seen them stay away with the spring and summer weather because it wasn't important. And in those days, the value systems, I look back at it now, mm-hmm. had a great relevance to motivation of Jewish life. Our concern, the value of Jewish life, our concern too, is a concern for people in need, for their health, for their welfare. And it carries over into the development of Hadassah, which took to this project the medical services. And that triggers off a great deal of attention. And that's why Hadassah is the most successful organization in America. Because when you make a contribution, you can visualize the Hadassah Hospital, which is treating Jews and Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it relates itself. The COA, by the way, in its 87 years, was the first major Zionist organization in America.
When did it develop?
1897.
In America?
About the same time as the first Zionist Congress.
I didn't realize that.
And at that time, Brandeis was very active in the ZOA.
Mm-hmm.
And so many other great leaders of the movement were beginning to become deeply involved to reinforce Herzl's concept that the only solution to the Jewish, to Jewish problems is the Jewish state.
Mm-hmm.
And they all jumped in. It wasn't easy. It didn't happen overnight. Mm-hmm. But the COA was the one agency which felt that their concern was to give some strength and some vitality and some permanence to the Jewish future.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, the ZOA was the agency which first developed the Jewish National Fund. So again, it led into how do we get a state? We didn't have a state. We bought the land.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Palestine and bought the land from the Arabs. And then to buy a land, the Jews are smart enough to know you can't have a forest. You can't have a desert. So they began to develop the land, and the Jewish National Fund was born.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we proceeded with the World Zionist Organization,
mm-hmm.
which came about 10 years or thereabouts. It came about 10 years after the Pittsburgh program?
Platform.
Mm-hmm. About 10 years after that came the consolidation of the World Zionist, which
mm-hmm.
meant that at that time there were other organizations. There was a great labor. Pittsburgh was the home of a great labor Zionist movement.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't exist today.
Mm-hmm.
But
when was the Pittsburgh Platform, do you know?
I could find out.
I think it was about 10 years before.
Something about that time. And following that, and again led by the ZOA, was the World Zionist Organization.
Right.
They felt that you began to have the labor Zionists, and Mizrahi became interested in. And that too is very interesting,
mm-hmm.
that the formation of the State of Israel, the caliber and the content of the State of Israel was the involvement of many different Jews
right.
have different opinions.
Right.
That by Jews who wanted to see a state to correlate with their value
right.
of a state. The Mizrahi organization, which is the religious organization, felt that there's a state purpose was to strengthen the religion. And they visualized a state which had religious concept and really was motivated by religion.
Right.
Then there was the labor Zionist movement, which started in Europe, in Poland. The labor Zionist movement became involved because they wanted a state where social justice prevailed. And out of that came the kibbutz movement. And they said, we're going to work for Palestine on condition that there's going to be a social system,
mm-hmm.
a socialist system.
Is that the Bund?
Pardon?
The labor Zionists, the Bund, is that the same thing? Isn't that?
Labor Zionists and what?
The Bund, B-U-N-D, the group?
Well, Verbund. Verbund is,
okay.
Verbund is a outpouring, outgrowth of the labor Zionist movement.
Mm-hmm.
They had many, by the way, and each organization had a lot of, you know, conservative attitudes, mm-hmm. the right and the left. There were the religious movement, the Mizrahi movement was not a singular movement, but they had people that believed in a stronger religion, people believed in a less intense religion, and the same thing was with the ZOA too.
Mm-hmm.
The ZOA actually represented in America the moderate, middle class capitalists.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that America prospered through capitalism. The individual's ability to promote himself through his own efforts,
mm-hmm.
and that's what capitalism, and the ZOA, the Zionist Organization of America, also felt as a principle that the way that Israel Palestine should develop must be in the area of the rights of the individual to control his destiny and his economy, the capitalism. And we've been identified with capitalism. And by the way, you might be interested to know that it's coming back now. You know, the labor movement is not as strong as it used to be, and they're getting more into the area of the world panorama,
mm-hmm.
of the rights of the individual to utilize his own talents,
yes.
and efforts to expand himself. And in Israel, you see it. Of course, in Israel, you have a powerful Histadrut,
right.
which was the outpouring of the movement, socialist movement. And the kibbutzim are an outgrowth of the same thing, where there is no individual, where there is no concept that people have to work to enhance their economy. They work harder, they earn more. And in the kibbutz movement, you get nothing. You don't. When you leave the kibbutz movement, you leave what you've started with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an outgrowth of the labor. And by the way, the movement is getting weaker, not stronger. The kibbutz movement is getting weaker, as you know, because we live in a world which is very much condensed, and every young fellow wants a car. And although Israel has a very extensive educational system, the kibbutzniks have to rely on the goodness of the kibbutz leadership to decide who goes to school and who doesn't, and they finance it for them.
They always like that.
The movement today is, in the kibbutz movement, that people, young people especially, are not running to the kibbutz. It's weakening,
mm-hmm.
because again, we have such a condensed world today that one of the items of young people, one of the desires and aspirations of young people in Israel is to have a pair of jeans.
Right.
And if you were there, you know that if you want to buy them a nice gift, buy them jeans. And where do the jeans come from? You know, and
mm-hmm.
the first year, not the first year, but about 10, 12 years ago, when I made one of my trips to Israel, and we came to Jerusalem, and we landed in a small hotel late at night, and we had dinner as a group. We were 40 people. In another group, there was a dance.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so excited about seeing the Israeli dancing in action, and I wanted to see the typical Israeli. You know what
yes,
I mean.
Yes.
And what do I see? Jitterbugging.
Yes.
I saw jitterbugging. That's what they were doing. So in Israel today, too.
Israel's changing, the world's changing.
Because
yes.
they follow the format of a world which is so condensed.
Mm-hmm.
That whatever happens, Pittsburgh is known as Israel in a half hour.
I mean, all this
augurs well to the development of social life and organizational life in America. And there have been some very radical changes. The COA is fighting right now to maintain an identity which it is not succeeding as it should. Those organizations, and I think this is significant, the organizations which do not lean on ideology. The COA leans on ideology. They do not lean Hadassah. When you join Hadassah as an organization, you don't think about Zionist organization. You think about you're supporting the medical services.
Yes.
Okay? And when you even the labor Zionists, the women are pretty strong. The men don't exist anymore, really, but the women are pretty strong. They're pioneer women. And my wife has been the leader of pioneer women is a labor Zionist women's organization. And they don't consider themselves Zionists. They support, I don't know, 100 clinics. As you know, they support clinics, the clinics for illegitimate children and for mothers that they're unmarried mothers and hospitals for the Arab women and hospitals for the Arab children. So you think in terms of a concept of an organization which has a tangible.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to get into a tangible too, because
people need that.
Well, you can't, in today's world, it is interesting because in today's world you find that everybody supports Israel.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be, and in my time I remember, there used to be an organization called the Council for Judaism, who were opposed to the State of Israel as a national homeland. They had an organization in New York, strong organization. We had great debates with them. It was only a recent year. They don't exist anymore because it is now accepted the fact that Israel is a member of the United Nations. We want to be like everybody else. We want to be like any other country in the world. Therefore, we're part of the United Nations, and we have spokesmen in the United Nations for Israel's rights and for Israel's security. And we latch on to the whole world political arena, where we know that when we come to the United States, who has been the main support of Israel, for arms and for money and for development projects and for medical services, we know that it's good for America, and America knows that it's good for America. So we become part of a world panorama, which has radically changed the movements, and we're having trouble with it. You know, you say, well, why should I belong to COA if I'm going to have this kid over here? Why don't you give me your membership? You know, we take time. It's important for us to have men of that stature. And we say, well, give me a definition of Zionism. I just came back from Texas. And it was, we have strong reasons in Texas. And do you know that I addressed a meeting, and there was a young person there who represents a group of young adults, and she said, give me a definition of Zionism. And I couldn't give her a definition of Zionism. It's a movement, it's a feeling. Basically, it's a feeling, it's a value system.
Mm-hmm.
The definition of Zionism really is that it's the Jewish liberation movement.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we live in a world today where we are liberated. We have the freedom, especially in America, and in most of Europe as well, except in Russia. And I had to come back and say, well, how do I reach you? How do I reach you to understand your affiliation with the Zionist support line? How do I reach you? We have to find means of reaching people. So we did something. I developed something 20 years ago, and it's been a tremendous contribution to Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
I developed an Israel scholarship program. It was my baby. And it's come tremendously. It's blossomed through the years.
Is it all over the country, or is it a Pittsburgh project?
It is we are the largest in the country. They have them here and there. They have strings attached to them.
Pittsburgh is the largest in the
country. First of all, Pittsburgh ZOA is the largest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not the largest. Next to Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Next to Baltimore. But our scholarship program is the largest. And I felt that this was a vehicle through which I could reach mm-hmm. people like that and say, look, when you want to support Zionism, here are kids that are going to go for they learn the identity, Jewish identity, which is Zionism.
Could we define other aspects of Zionism from the beginning? The later Zionist movement was more of a socialist movement. The Mizrahi was a religious movement that truly believed that this is what God promised. Herzl's idea was a little different, wasn't it?
Well, Herzl's idea was that the solution, that a Jewish homeland was a solution to the Jewish problem. Because
political homeland.